Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, October 13, 2020. The South Sudan police have detained a woman at Juba International Airport.
What happened is that she was trying to travel outside the country without the knowledge of the police, and knowing that the case, she's very essential figure in the case of these children.
And a court in Jonglei State sentences cattle raiders to death.
It is in relation to the cattle because the disease has been attacked in the forest. He's been beaten by the sticks up to death, and his two cattle have been raided while they have been found with the two accused.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan National Police Service has detained the mother of three children who were killed in Juba's Rock City area in early August after she attempted to leave the country on Monday. Police spokesman says they are investigating the motives behind her travel plans. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Gilda Gideon Juma was arrested at Juba International Airport on Monday while trying to board an Egyptian airline destined for Cairo, according to South Sudan Police spokesperson Major General Daniel Justin. She was not a suspect in the murders of her three children, aged 9, 7 and 4, who were found in their home with their throats cut. Justin says police have been questioning Juma about why she attempted to leave the country under a fake name while the murder trial for her children was underway.
What happened is that she was trying to travel outside the country without the knowledge of the police, and knowing that the case, she's a very essential figure in the case of these children. As I said, the investigation will show us all those details.
Justin says Juma was arrested while carrying a pony passport bearing the name of Gilda Kawenda. 4 days after the children were murdered on August 1st, South Sudan police announced the arrest of Babu Emmanuel Lokiri, identified as a relative, as the man responsible for the murder of three children. Lokiri was held in detention until last Friday when the hearing got underway. Relatives said Juma was in court on Friday, but absent during Monday's court session. They later heard she was arrested at the airport. Alfred Taban, a paternal uncle to the slain children, says he does not understand why Juma was trying to leave the country.
We, the relatives of those three children, we are worried. We are not happy because the case is still on the process. How come that the mother of these three children, which she was keen to look trouble to another country, when the case is on the process? Because we are in the court, and the mother was in the airport going to Egypt. This is not fair.
Wilson Lodiung, another relative of the children, says Juma's decision to try to leave the country is disturbing to the Rock City community of Juba.
We are very sad simply because a case of your own children, you begin to leave the case, you want to leave the country and the case is not finished. We really feel that because by her leaving, if she was to leave, then automatically we could say that they conspired against the killing of our children.
Police produced Juma today in the court, where the judge asked her why she tried to leave the country, according to Lodiung.
She was saying her presence in Juba, she thinks that if she leaves Juba, a certain spirit will come to her. Because once she's in Juba, she always dreams and the children begin to suffer, and she felt that if she could go away, then maybe a very good air will come to her and then she will have another good wind. Some people say, no, that is a mistake. You are not supposed to leave before your children are the case is finalized.
Lodiung says Juma will spend her second day at Mauna Police Station, where she is being detained. He says she will be back in court tomorrow when the hearing resumes. Residents were shocked by the news of three slain siblings in Rock City. President Salva Kiir Mayardit called the murders a heinous crime. The girls were the children of Edward Jami Andrea, a lecturer at the Upper Nile University in the capital. They were alone in their house while their mother was at the market. A motive for the murders has yet to be identified. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
A court in the Jonglei State capital, Bor, has sentenced two men found guilty of cattle raiding and murder to death by hanging. The presiding judge, John Yale, says the two men were convicted for murder and robbery under Section 206 and 305 of the South Sudan Penal Code Act of 2008. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Juba.
Jonglei State High Court Judge John Yela Liu sentenced 30-year-old Kurwil Majug Mayom and 25-year-old Chol Manyel Jol to death by hanging. The two men were found guilty of killing John Boldut and stealing his two cows last December when the cattle was being moved from Bor to Awerial County in Lakes State. Judge Yela explained why he sentenced the two men to death.
It is in relation to the cattle because the disease has been attacked in the forest. He's been beaten by the sticks up to death, and his two cattle have been raided while they have been found with the two accused.
Police originally arrested four suspects but later released two men. Judge Yell says Majuk and Manuel were found guilty of murder and robbery under two sections of the 2008 South Sudan Penal Code Act.
The court takes his procedures, and today he passed the judgment that the two accused, Kurwil Majok and Chol Manyel, that have been convicted under Section 248 and 206 Penal Code Act 2008 and have been sentenced to death.
Complainant Michael Kurdut, a brother of the deceased, welcomes judge's decision. Dut says Majok and Manyel murdered his brother and therefore should receive capital punishment.
We welcome the judge's decision as the relatives of the deceased, because this gentleman was killed intentionally. Why? Because of his cattle. He was not a cattle keeper. He was just a university student who was taking his cows to the cattle camp.
Malwen Nyok, an uncle to both of the convicted men, says the ruling is unfair. He claims there was no direct evidence linking his nephews to John Boldut's murder.
There is no evidence that shown that this gentleman beat the deceased with a stick. No one saw them doing that. We see that cattle get lost, and these cattle were lost, and that is why they were being kept, so that the owner would come and take them. So we are going to appeal the court ruling.
Cattle raids and child abductions are rampant in Jonglei State, but very few suspected cattle raiders are ever arrested and prosecuted in court. David Garang, a civil society activist with the Jonglei Civil Society Network in Bor, says Monday's court sentencing sends a strong message.
If they are sentenced to death, that is the right way of doing it, because there's no one who has right to take the life of other person. So it is a very good step for the justice to take its course. Because this time here, we need justice to avail. If there is justice, then all these atrocities will get stopped.
Garang says communities will only be safe when cattle raiders, child abductors, and other perpetrators of serious crimes are arrested and brought to justice. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
The Sudanese transitional government has adopted the comprehensive peace agreement signed in Juba. The agreement was incorporated into Sudan's constitution. A member of the technical team tasked with reconciling the peace agreement and the constitution says the committee has completed its work and expects the government to announce major changes soon. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
The adoption of two new documents incorporating the peace agreement occurred Monday at a joint meeting between the Sudanese Sovereign Council and cabinet members who are carrying out the work of the legislature during the transitional period. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus in Khartoum today, Muhammad Saleh, a member of the technical committee tasked with reconciling the peace deal and the constitution, says they completed their work within 9 days instead of the time frame of 10 days provided by the Juba peace agreement. Saleh says, now that the transitional government has adopted the peace agreement and the amended constitution, announcements regarding those changes should be made to the executive body within the coming days.
3 additional members will be added to the Sovereign Council within 7 days from the day of the direct incorporation of the peace agreement into constitutional document. So by 20 of October, if things goes according to the matrix of implementation, the Sovereign Council should be announced to the Sudanese people. In addition to that also, the executive authority should be adapted to accommodate that the signatories to the agreement should have a share of 25%.
The Sudanese government signed a peace deal with the 9 rebel groups earlier this month in Juba, ending years of conflict in eastern Sudan, Blue Nile, and Sudan's western region of Darfur. Saleh says the new constitution will be in place for 39 months, beginning on October 3rd. It will replace the current 18 states and establish up to 8 regions to be governed by governors instead of rulers or walis. Saleh says within the next 50 days, the government should form a national legislative assembly, which, he says, will relieve the burden of work on both councils.
According to the matrix of implementation, we should have the new national parliament. So, and in this, the share of the signatories to the peace agreement will have 75 members, or a percentage of 25. If the total number remained 300, then we will have 75 members. If the number increased, then we will have a constant share, which is equivalent to 25%.
Saleh says the new constitution will allow members of the Sudanese Revolutionary Front to hold national positions once they run in national elections.
This will increase the domain of participation of the people representing vast majority of the Sudanese people, especially from the margins and the regions. Add to that also, we have the exception doesn't include the governors. This exception only for the members in the Sovereign Council and members in the Council of Ministers.
Under the deal, Sudan's government is expected to issue a general amnesty for all leaders who are signatories to the peace agreement so that they can help in implement the deal.
Now, according to the matrix of implementation, 13 provisions should be taken. Like the general amnesty should be issued by the head of the state. Of the Sovereign Council, he should issue the general amnesty to allow all the leaders of the signatories to the agreement to come to Khartoum. According to the program, provisional program now, all the leaders of the Sudanese Revolutionary Front and the other components of the signatory parties should come to Khartoum by the 3rd of November.
Saleh called on all the Sudanese people to embrace the agreement and support the new government. He also called on holdout groups to engage in negotiations with the government so that Sudan can achieve lasting peace. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the effects of floods on East Africa. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you could swap lives for a day, who would you swap with and why?
I'll swap with our finance minister because I think he's doing a yeoman job and I want to have a feel of what he goes through in a day.
I'll change with my dad because I love him so much. He has been there for us. I mean, like, he has taken us in good schools. He has taken care of us because for us, our mom is not working. We depend on our dad.
If I was to swap with someone, I feel I admire myself more than anyone in this life, and I feel I'm capable of doing what those people are doing, so I would not swap for any person.
I would like to change position with the president because I feel it would be nice to give instruction to everyone.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
VOA always delivers your favorite programs, news, music, entertainment, and sports shows. Starting Monday, October 5th, our flagship news show, South Sudan in Focus, will be moving to 16:30 UTC, followed by your favorite sports show, The Sunny Side of Sports, at 1700 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Candidates in Uganda's upcoming parliamentary elections have until Thursday to pay a nomination fee of little more than $800 to the Electoral Commission. However, some don't have the money, forcing political parties to appeal for support on social media. Analysts say the fee is too high. For VOA News, Salima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Last week, Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as the singer Bobby Wine, asked his followers on social media to financially support parliamentary candidates running under his National Unity Platform Party. He said that as the nomination period draws to a close, the party has many candidates, especially from Western and Northern Uganda, who risk being unable to run because they don't have the required 3 million shillings, equal to about $800. Wine accused President Yoweri Museveni and his allies of making it expensive to run for office simply to lock out the opposition. Joel Senyonyi, the National Unity Platform spokesperson and a parliamentary candidate himself, said in a phone interview the fee is locking them out.
There is no direct correlation between somebody being wealthy and being a good leader. Many of the people who are corrupt, who are stealing taxpayers' money, are already stinking rich. If you look at our existing parliament, many of those people actually were not well to do the time they got into parliament. So they were campaigning on borders, bicycles, door-to-door on foot and so on. And people said, look, you don't have the means, but you are potentially a good leader. We are going to entrust you with our vote.
The executive committee of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party is meeting Monday to decide how much the party will contribute to a member's nomination fee. During previous elections, the party paid its candidates' nomination fees, raising questions as to its source of funds. Emmanuel Dombo, the NRM Director for Communication, says this is the value of belonging to a political party.
It is burdensome, but it's a responsibility parties must undertake in order to ensure coherence within organizations. Because if you fail to pay nomination fees for your candidates, then how can you have control over them as members of parliament?
Patrick Wakida, head of Research World International, an organization that carries out political opinion surveys in Uganda, says candidates competing against members of the ruling party start the election at a disadvantage. In his opinion, the Electoral Commission doesn't need the money raised by the nomination fees.
Ideally, they shouldn't be charging. They already funded. They already have money from the treasury. When they go the extent of again asking people for 3 million shillings, in my view, that is not proper. It puts very many people to the disadvantage.
The Electoral Commission maintains it is Parliament that established the fee and they are only following the law. Uganda's parliamentary and presidential elections are set to take place in January or February of next year. The ruling NRM currently holds close to a two-thirds majority in the 458-seat body. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
At least 3,000 Cameroonian teachers have refused offers by the Central African States military to transport teaching staff to school in the conflict-prone English-speaking regions. The teachers who fled separatist attacks, looting, burning, and occupation of their schools in the English-speaking regions say they are not sure of their safety as some separatist fighters are again threatening to kill teachers and students who go to school. For VOA News, Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaounde.
47-year-old primary school teacher Fru Isaac says he has refused an offer by the Cameroon military to take him to his school in the restive English-speaking region. However, Fru said Friday, six of his peers accepted the offer to be transported by the military from the town of Bamenda Tundop in the English-speaking Northwest region.
The authorities are now taking the teachers who cannot access their stations in armored cars. But the question is, when you successfully take them there, how will the teachers cope in the absence of these armored cars?
Fru said he remained convinced that fighters were still hiding in the bush ready to commit atrocities on teachers and students when the military transport leaves. However, Henderson Ketong, the highest government official in the English-speaking Northwestern Gokutunya Division, where NDOP is located, says teachers who fail to return to school will be punished. Ketong says the military will also find and punish people he describes as agents sent by separatists to threaten parents if they send their children to school.
Anybody, especially teachers who continue to insist on boycott, should know that they have another agenda which is hidden. And woe betide anybody who will still continue to carry out campaign and sensitization for this doctrine of boycott.
Cameroon's military said it has been on standby since October 5, when the country's 2020-2021 school year began, to transport teachers, students and administrative staff to schools in English-speaking towns and villages. The military said they acted to ensure that schools closed for the past 4 years as a result of the separatist crisis can reopen their doors so thousands of children can have access to education. However, Cameroon's ministries in charge of elementary and secondary education said more than 3,000 teachers did not show up last week. Cameroon reported that 140 of close to 500 schools closed by fighters within the past 4 years had reopened, with about 30,000 anxious children in attendance. Some Anglophone activists have asked for schools to be reopened, saying it was a human rights abuse to continue to deprive children of education. The Teachers Association of Cameroon said at least 300 teachers responded to the calls and returned to schools in the English-speaking regions. The association said many of the teachers preferred to return on their own for fear of being identified with the military by fighters. However, a group calling itself the Interim Governing Council of Ambazonia, the nation they are fighting to create, said it had banned all schools controlled by Cameroon's central government in Yaoundé from operating in the English-speaking regions. It said it had ordered its fighters to abduct teachers and students who dare go to school. Colonel Louis Fesso, in charge of road safety at Cameroon's Defense Ministry, says special troops have been deployed to assure the safety of the teachers and students in all English schools.
Our forces made it possible to restore serenity in these areas affected by crisis. We can therefore reassure the entire educational community in these areas about the protective measures being taken by the defense and security forces for a smooth and successful 2020-2021 academic year.
Cameroon's government is also encouraging the creation of militias around schools to inform the military of any strange movements and visitors. The separatist conflict in Cameroon has left over 3,000 people dead and half a million displaced, according to the United Nations. The crisis started in 2016 when teachers and lawyers took to the streets to complain about the overbearing influence of the French language in the bilingual country. The military responded with a crackdown, and separatists took up weapons, claiming that they were defending civilians. They asked for a school shutdown and vowed to make the English-speaking regions ungovernable. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
In recent months, unpredictable, intense floods have washed across parts of Kenya, Sudan, Ethiopia, and several other East and Central African countries, ruining homes and livelihoods. At the same time, people and governments are battling a global pandemic. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to those affected in East Africa.
As the world battles a pandemic, large swaths of the African continent have been, literally, submerged by floods. Since March, this crisis has left more than 400 people dead in East Africa. A separate round of flooding has hit West Africa's Sahel region. In Uganda, Catholic Relief Services estimates that as many as 580,000 people are affected. Country Director Nick Dehoy.
It's kind of affecting all kinds of people. You know, in Kampala, our capital city, it affects people who have nice houses on the lake shore. But if you are in the Mount Elgon area on the border with Kenya, or you're in the Kasese area on the border with the DR Congo, and you're a smallholder farmer who normally benefits from farming on a riverbank, and suddenly there's this raging flash flood that comes down the hills and mountains because of this very intense rainfall, you know, you lose everything. You lose your house, you lose your land. And so it's a very diverse group of people that is affected.
In the eastern town of Jinja, along the shores of Lake Victoria, radio host and environmental activist John Hillary says flooding doesn't just destroy homes, it ruins the very fabric that holds society together.
The public hospital, the only public hospital in the Chilembe region, completely destroyed. So people, as a result of the floods, got sick, but they could not get anywhere else to go to because the hospital had been destroyed.
Dehoy says heavy rainfall is normal in East Africa. What isn't, he says, is the frequency and intensity. And he says the pandemic makes it harder for groups like his to respond.
It's like a triple crisis in Uganda, right? We have the locusts, we have all the floods, and then on top of everything else, we have COVID-19. And so it's been, for the affected people, it's been an especially hard year to be on a lockdown and be affected by floods. And then because of the lockdown, accessing the support and the relief that they are entitled to.
Hillary, who speaks often about climate change on his radio show, says that to him and other activists, this is personal.
My mom is a gardener, my grandparents, and many people in my family are farmers. That's what I've known. Growing up, I always went with my mom to the garden to dig, and we ate food from the gardens. Over time, we have noticed that because of what I think is negligence, we've been involved in practices that have completely destroyed our rain cycle. Our climate is deteriorating every other day. I'm only 26. I have seen over time my world deteriorating. I don't want to see the same for my children.
This, he says, is a living nightmare. This is his home, and he wants future generations to see its beauty too. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Before we end this show, I have a special announcement for you. This program can now be heard in South Sudan at 7:30 p.m. local time on VOA affiliate stations. Please inform your friends and relatives. That's all we had prepared for you this Tuesday, when I'll leave you with the song Vulindela by Brenda. Listening to Brenda Fassi with the song Vulindela, which means open the way. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your vehicles, homes, and phones. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your home. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.